Good morning.
We have an artist experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we'll be talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it if you can while you're listening. It will really enhance your experience.
Well, good morning, everyone. Today, Sheila and I are going to present a different kind of show to our listeners. I've titled the show Nature as Art, A Visual Philosophy. For 70 shows now, could you believe it, Sheila?
Amazing.
The Artist Experience radio show has taken to so many assorted venues to see, ruminate, and experience beauty. Today, we're going to ask you to engage your senses in art by just going into nature. There are so many wonderful places and opportunities to experience this right here in Tacoma Park, like in your own backyard. Certainly, Washington is one of the greenest cities in the entire U.S., and it's a place where nature is in proximity almost all the time. You can go to the Tidal Basin, the National Arboretum, the Smithsonian National Zoo. There's the grounds at Tudor Place and the Hillwood Museum and Mansion. And you can venture out into the burbs like Great Falls in Maryland, Virginia, and possibly even Mount Vernon. But Sheila and I wanted to take you to Dunbarton Oaks Gardens. It's a lovely oasis and a treat for all of us to experience nature as art in a garden setting. First, I'd like Sheila to give you a little bit of background about these wonderful gardens in Dunbarton Oaks.
Sure. Well, with the rise of the upper class in America, the industrial barons, they would travel in Europe with their families, and they took back ideas from the estates and gardens, and they built homes for their families in America using some of those ideas. These mansions were so showpieces for entertaining and for living, and at the same time, coming from the ideas of the Transcendentalists, there was a new awareness about the healing powers of nature. This extended to the middle class so that health and well-being of the families could thrive by spending time in the garden. Robert Woods Bliss was a diplomat, a philanthropist, and an art collector who had been living with his wife Mildred in Brussels. And then World War I broke out. So Mildred, who was with the Red Cross, founded the American Ambulance Field Service, which distributed clothing and supplies to the troops. And for this, she was made a Chevalier of the French Legion of Honor. So she was a force in her own right.
My goodness, yeah.
They came to Washington, where Bliss was posted at the State Department, and they brought their home with 54 acres in Upper Georgetown, which is
nice.
Amazing now when you think about that. And they did extensive renovations on the house, and then Mildred forged a close collaboration with Beatrix Ferrand, who was a landscape architect and a horticulturist, and for over 30 years they worked together and they transformed the grounds into a series of garden rooms, which we will visit later in this show.
Well, Sheila, you know, I found it so coincidental that the Bliss family created such bliss at Dunbarton Oaks. Just too much for me. The Dunbarton Oaks Gardens is an enchanting array of gardens, terraces, walks, and spaces that are meditative places to go and sit and immerse oneself in nature. There are wonderful vistas, there are viewpoints to look at the undulating landscape and the canopies and to look beyond. Of course, it's a great place to sketch, but I want to emphasize for this show, just go and absorb creation and growth in that experience and leave the art tools behind. On the corner of where the gardens and the museum intersect is an engraved plaque with words written by Mildred Bliss. It's short but powerful. Those responsible for scholarship should remember that the humanities cannot be fostered by confusing instruction with education. That was my husband's as well as my wish that the Mediterranean interpretation of the humanist disciplines shall predominate, that gardens have their place in the humanist order of life, and that trees are noble elements to be protected by successive generations and are not to be neglected or lightly destroyed. What I think is special about this quote is the writing about humanistic disciplines. What are those? Well, this is the general knowledge and intellectual skills about the world that makes one human. The disciplines like language, philosophy, religions and spiritual ideals, the arts and the laws that make us human. And I feel that we're not going to take you to an untouched primordial forest today, but we want to just set the groundwork to the central order of walking, seeing, smelling, and hearing nature as experience, as you would look at a painting or a three-dimensional sculpture in a museum, or even a performance piece in a museum or a theater setting. A simple walk in the garden can be as stimulating an art experience as going to a museum. As spring is here and beauty is exponentially revealing itself, it's a superb time to see nature as art, and in some way, creation as art.
A quote from Leonardo da Vinci, "The painter strives and competes with nature." I think that is so great. And flowers are surely like the most perfect events. And I mean an event because it's an ongoing thing. It's not just a static thing. And looking at this miracle is an event. It's form, color, texture, and smell. It's life sparks just for a fleeting moment, and then it's gone. And in its cycle of reproduction, a flower gives us a sense of gentle urgency. And so many painters from the earliest times have tried to capture flowers for all time.
And, you know, coincidentally, this week, May 2nd, was the 500th anniversary of the death of Leonardo da Vinci. Well, it's really known that Leonardo da Vinci was a very physically fit individual. He would take off and walk, and he would walk, and he would walk, and he would look at the natural world around him. He was very happy immersing himself in nature. He did not write about it as inspiration. He wrote about it as experience. And here's a quote from Leonardo as well. "Although nature commences with reason and ends in experience, it is necessary for us to do the opposite. That is to commence with experience and from this to proceed to investigate reason." Wow. I mean, that's just exactly what the show's about. So Leonardo and I we're fueling each other's energy 500 years apart. Leonardo observed and witnessed birds flying from particularly unusual perspectives as he was walking above the birds around the hills of Florence. Think about that. He was above the birds. He experienced the birds in flight. Well, it was only after many observations that Leonardo began to investigate why and how he could apply that to himself and his own life, thus the mechanics of flight. Most of us probably know that he invented the helicopter. I mean, that's, you know, where Leonardo was out. He was out and about in a lot of places, but his experience of creation was the creativity.
By the first century AD, botanical illustration had already been established through close observation, naturalistic drawings, sometimes in the service of science and sometimes in the services of art. These drawings began to appear in the settings of medieval books and all through the Renaissance. Two great plant illustrators were Leonardo da Vinci and Albrecht Dürer. This is the most beautiful drawing by Dürer, which is almost photographic in its accuracy. And it's almost a landscape in its scope. It takes in so much.
Yeah, it's a masterpiece.
It's a masterpiece. The pinnacle of flower paintings was the 17th century Dutch paintings of botanical subjects that had developed in the context of still life paintings. But the arrangements had no rhyme or reason. The groupings of plants in Dürer were unusual because they could be seen in a single habitat. But that wouldn't become common practice until the plein air landscape painters became popular 150 years later. So until then, sketches of flowers would serve. They would serve artists as a kind of a paper garden that the artist could kind of pluck these flowers and arrange them wherever they went. Who cares about the season?
You got that right, Sheila. Who cares about the season? Your introduction, Sheila, also addresses the artist and the visual communicator as a scientist as well. Of course, Albrecht Dürer brought the Italian Renaissance to Northern Europe, and like his Italian Renaissance comrades, the artist and the scientist were one. The artist was the philosopher, the mathematician, the physicist, the anatomist, the geographer, and the astronomer. Well, it's just like the horticulturist, like the one that, you know, helped build Dumbarton Oaks, and the landscape architects and the landscapers, they were artists as well. So I think this is kind of a wonderful thing, because the observer in all this is also the artist, and that's why the gardens are a great place to basically hang out.
Yeah. Well, towards the end of the 19th century, there was a widespread belief that gardens had a sort of moral benefit, that the family could spend time together and relax, and the father could think deep thoughts, and the mothers could sit quietly in a soft white dress and watch the children play. This subject has been popularized with Impressionism and beyond. Tea in the garden. So many artists in France, Matisse, Bonnard, Pissarro, and many, many Americans, John Lafarge, William Merritt Chase, John Singer Sargent, they created a beautiful vision of the middle class. John Lafarge, an American painter and botanist, made frequent trips to Newport, Rhode Island to study the plants in their natural settings and painted some fabulous watercolors. These artists had a great objection to contrived arrangements, and Lafarge had a fascination with the water lily that Henry David Thoreau had earlier. Thoreau believed that there was a life force beyond visible appearances of things, and an individual, instead of laboriously creating a painting, recommended that whoever takes his advice should become an artist of his own day and realize the profound and sublime truth of the natural world. A wonderful painter of gardens is Maria Oakley Dewing, who preceded Monet's paintings of water lilies by filling her canvas with flowers. It had no horizon line and still some indication of the space, so that for the viewer, you're in the perspective of the gardener. You're sort of down low, immersed in the foliage and the flowers. She hated the inaccuracies of Dutch flower painting and was disdainful of a tulip placed in a bouquet with a passion flower. These artists believe, as many of us do, that plants could and should be part of one's life. So it stands to reason that many painters have been great gardeners. In fact, it could be considered that gardening is living sculpture.
Yeah, well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it really is. So Monet, he's the most famous for his gardens at Giverny in Normandy in northern France, and they are the most visited. The most astonishing fact about Monet is he created his world so that he could paint it. He always had a garden, even when he couldn't afford to buy a house. He would plant dahlias, especially around his rental property, because he had to have a garden to look at. And then when he bought Giverny, he borrowed the money. And at first, he did most of the gardening work himself, planting banks of flowers and varieties, not formal like the gardens we think of in France, you know, with the walkways, the gravel pathways. But on this side of wildness, and it awakened his eyes to different unorthodox combinations, surprises of dark red with light pinks, understanding that the greens will make everything harmonize. Gravel paths, tall trees in the background, looking natural, in some ways accidental compared with the formal English gardens.
Well, I mean, Monet was a wild kind of guy,
God.
He made wild gardens. Yeah. I mean, it makes total sense.
Yes, it does. It does. What a way to live. And he lived in Giverny for 43 long years, and his house and gardens became more luscious over time. And wisteria, azalea, rose, and peony. There's also a pond of which you must all know about, with a Japanese bridge, weeping willows, and of course the water lilies that are immortalized in his paintings and his series of water lilies, or Les Nymphées. Monet's works of art are the source of Impressionism. His early paintings were of gardens, sort of formal and stiff compositions, often with a lovely maid with a parasol. He used perspective to lure your eye into the space. But later, with the water lilies, he painted the surface of the water by floating the plants on the surface. So he never really gives you what the surface is, except that the plants are floating on it. And then you can look underneath the water and you can see what's underneath and the reflections of the clouds moving overhead and the shadows from the trees on the banks. When I first saw these paintings, so it's a long time ago now, which is in the Angere Museum in Paris, I was immersed in this vision and the genius of its creation. It is unbelievable.
Absolutely. He takes his own creation of the gardens to another level. The sublime. He's going towards the sublime in nature, and I think he was quite successful with that. Well, speaking of the Angere, Dumbarton Oaks has an Angere as well, and that was built in 1810. And it has a beautiful creeping fig that was planted in 1860 in that space. That plant that we saw, Sheila, was planted in 1860. Imagine that. Well, you could almost imagine. It's a lovely place used traditionally for entertaining, and it has a charm of yesteryear. And I kind of was thinking when we were in that space, Sheila, that the ghosts of the upwardly mobile Washingtonians seem to haunt the space. It's one of the oldest parts of the gardens, and yeah. I know, I found it a bit creepy, actually. Creepy and the creeping fig, yeah, I know.
Well, many, many painters cultivated beautiful gardens specifically to give them a pleasing natural subject to paint. Gardens were especially popular with the Impressionists, whose vivid color sense, broad brush strokes, and the appreciation of nature paired perfectly with the garden as a subject. And you know, in these Impressionist paintings, the flowers are perfect subject because of the brush strokes, because they could have the very lively brush strokes that really don't show you, and Monet doesn't either, a single flower or any kind of the anatomy of the flower. They're just like the feeling, the way the flowers kind of float around and engulf you.
Yeah, it's the impression of the flower.
The impression of the flower.
And the color and the texture. Right. Yeah, it's perfect. Perfect subject.
Yeah, and Van Gogh wasn't an avid gardener himself. I mean, that's not the Van Gogh we know about, right?
No, he wasn't.
But he was a very careful observer of plants and the gardens he spent time in. Obviously meant a lot to him and inspired his work. When he was a boy, he was a very lonely kid, and he'd go out and he'd lie down next to the plants, next to the water or whatever they had in Holland, the puddles, and he would carefully observe and draw these plants. So he was already an artist. If it should have been clear to anyone who had been paying attention, he was already an artist. And Van Gogh greatly admired the painter Charles-Francois Daubigny. And after Daubigny died, Van Gogh traveled to the artist's home and spent his time painting Daubigny's expansive garden. The garden is depicted in many of Van Gogh's works.
Daubigny was a fantastic painter. Wow. Probably a lesser known Barbizon school painter.
Probably, but I love his work.
His work is fantastic.
It's beautiful.
It has a lot of mystery to it.
Mm-hmm. And Bonnard, of course, I can't ever leave
out. I was waiting
Bonnard.
For Bonnard.
Here he is.
Sheila Blake's one of her favorites, if not her most favorite painter.
Yes, he had a few gardens that he painted all the time. And I was so fortunate to visit the gardens of Bonnard. I was with some friends, and we walked past his gardens. And, of course, it's funny, in Le Canet, who really lives there is the Aga Khan, or lived there. And nobody knows about Bonnard. Like, when you go to Aix-en-Provence and you visit, everything is Cézanne. Cézanne High School, Cézanne Service Station, Cézanne Boulevard. But you go around and you try to find Bonnard, and nobody knows. But our friends, who were French, they spoke with somebody, and they said, oh, Bonnard, yes, you should go and see this woman. And she studied with Bonnard. So there was an old woman, and she had taken classes with Bonnard. And she said, oh, I'll tell you where to go. So we walked all the way up the hill, up and up and up, till we could see the Mediterranean from the gardens. And there was a house, and there was a painter painting, you know, a house painter painting the gate of the garden. And my friend, very nicely in French, said, oh, my friend is an artist. Do you think you could just open the gate and let us peek into the garden?
Knowing people in funny places.
This was so amazing. And the artist said, I will give your friend a treat. And he took us, he opened the gates and took us into the garden and into the house. And the, you know, Bonnard's, the family of his sister, the Terrasses, they lived there. It was a home. And you could see the things that he painted and how they were transformed in his paintings. I can remember it now. I was so blown away.
I could hardly breathe. I bet.
And I threw my camera to Peter and I said, take pictures. And the pictures didn't come out. We were both so nervous, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were in the studio where Bonnard did his painting. Oh, my God.
Oh my
it
God.
Really was. I would say one of the most thrilling moments of my life. And so he composed his paintings through the window or from the porch of his sister's family's home. And he especially loved the children who were her nieces and his nieces and nephews. And Bonnard took hundreds of photographs. He was kind of crazy about this camera. And he took pictures of Marthe. And in the nude sometimes, in the trees, and some of the kids playing around or riding on their donkey, and they were picnicking. He took pictures of their life. And, of course, French life is very lovely. And it's sort of great to see the photographs of his home. And it's especially interesting, the translation of, because I have seen some films also of the places that Bonnard lived, and they are not spectacular. They're kind of ordinary. Hmm. And he would, I mean, not ordinary for you and me, but, you know, it's Dumbarton is a mansion compared to these places. And yet, just his eye would transform like a railing or a steps into those beautiful paintings.
Oh, see, that's what artists, do. It sounds like you had one heck of an experience there. That's like that's a jewel experience. Well, you know, Sheila, but you have a fabulous yard, and you know, you have a lovely garden on your property. The creative spirit always has been very comfortable in nature. It almost seems to me like an imperative. A garden is an imperative for an artist, and especially the visual artist. So, you know, you've been living that life as well, just like Bonnard. You're a soulmate.
Yeah, but you, Tom, the minute you come in my house, you say, how are your orchids doing? My orchids are blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate them.
But here's the truth. Peter and I do have a garden. We have a pretty much of a yard.
Beautiful.
And by this time, we've been living in this house for 20 years. So by this time, we've probably planted most everything in that garden, including the trees. And it's just part of our life. Since coming to Maryland, Maryland is a wonderful climate. It has just enough winter to rest from the summer of the garden. And it's still a lot of work. And like painting, when I look at my garden, there's always something that needs to be changed or something that died. Like, what happened to that hibiscus plant I painted? There's often not enough sun. And then we have a haphazard way of not planning anything. But it does look great.
Oh, for sure.
It does.
It's lovely.
Yeah. And it serves me really well as a resource for plants and leaves and trees. I can use it as a sort of book of plants. So when my paintings, I have a necessity to paint like some background trees, I just look out my studio window and I can sort of take that and use it or get right down next to a plant and you know, so I have a space to fill in and I can use those plants. They don't really, I mean, kind of like, you know, what we were talking about earlier. I'll have plants from all different seasons in my painting. I don't pay attention. If I need a red rose bush, okay, there it is. Yeah. It could be planted next to something that would only be in the spring. Who cares? So because it's what I can look at, it's very necessary for me to have it there. And yes, when I go out to get the newspaper the first thing in the morning, I go up the stairs and I look down in my yard and I'm kind of blown away. It's a really wonderful thing. I'm just overcome that I live here.
Well, you know, I think beautiful. One of the things that you're kind of alluding to also is that there's a spiritual essence to your garden, your property, and it's a place you could do Tai Chi in, Qigong, you know, it has that quality where there's little, little places and spaces you can do that. And you know, it's true. You and Peter truly appreciate that landscape. And you've surrounded yourselves with it. You've created it. And, you know, sometimes I think people try to win over nature and control it. And, you know, yes, things die and are born and reborn. But this is what nature does. And I believe this symbiotic relationship is what we're kind of talking about. It's the balance between nature and us humans. It's a kind of a union that we need to work together at to maximize the experience and the beauty. And I think that's what you guys have been working on for years.
And also, it's a symbiotic relationship with a deer.
Yes.
And the rabbits and whoever wants to eat all the stuff in our garden.
No, I mean, you know, that's a big issue, you know, nowadays. But, you know, let them have a little nibble.
Oh, yeah, a little nosh.
You know, it's like, you know, it's so amazing. I was staring out my window. I saw a black squirrel with a red tail yesterday. Ooh. And I was like, wow, I never noticed this guy right on that tree right outside my balcony. And it was so pleasurable. Well, we're going to take a station break. But Sheila, you uncovered a really interesting piece of music that was commissioned by the Bliss couple. Share a little about this.
Sure. Well, Mildred and Robert Bliss commissioned for their 30th anniversary. They commissioned Igor Stravinsky to write this piece called Dumbarton Oaks. It's also concerto in E-flat. And it was performed in their music room at Dumbarton for their wedding anniversary. Now, that's a beautiful thing.
That's
it's
amazing.
Really great. So we're going to play a little bit for you now. And we also want to thank our listeners for making generous contributions to our radio station in our recent fund drive. We could not do all this fabulous programming without your true support and generosity. Let's listen, and we'll see you here in a few. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD LP Tacoma Park.
Well, so many artists have been inspired by nature, all kinds of artists, musicians, poets, dancers, and of course, the visual artists. Their inspiration to create something in their own form of expression is really not what we're talking about today. We would like to offer that nature is in fact the art itself, without having to create anything in response to it. So, Sheila, I'm going to begin my philosophizing on this by talking about language and the root of creation and creativity. The phenomenon of creation and creativity are bound by the similar root word. The biological, physiological, and possibly psychological pathways to creation and creativity have been long debated in science. Both creation and creativity in many ways present mysteries. So I'd like to start with the verb to create and the noun creation. They both come from the Latin creatus, which is the past participle of the Latin word creare, which means to bring into being. It also means to make grow, to bring forth, to produce, to procreate, and to cause. Thus, as you are in nature and you're experiencing nature, you become a witness and a participant in the act of growth with that which is before you. So you're part of this experience when you're in nature. The importance here is that you are the witness and the participant. Your presence in nature makes you part of nature as experience. Now I'm going to tie this with the noun creativity and the adjective creative, which are of course related to the words I just talked about, to create and creation. These words are related to the word ceres, which is in Latin, and these words come from the word crescere, which is Italian and Latin, and it means to grow and to arise from. Well, in modern language, it means to have the faculty and the ability and character of growing and arising from something. Aha! So what I'm trying to communicate is here is that in experiencing nature, as in effect, it's an art performance about growth, in which you're the participation in nature makes you a player in a kind of a cause and effect relationship. So your place or our place in nature should be a growing experience like nature itself before us. Just like when you said, Sheila, before, the flower opens in front of you and you see that, you become part of that flower. It's a very kind of emotional, psychological thing. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, you know, go home to create a piece of artwork when you're inspired that in nature. You can, but you don't have to, because your experience in nature is the art. Mm-hmm. That's my big shtick today.
That's a good one.
Essentially, you are the art when you are one with it in nature. Does that make any sense, Sheila?
Well, it makes total sense in the context of what our whole program is about.
Yes, thank you.
That you are part of the experience, that the experience comes alive in you. That's what we're talking about. And that's what Thoreau said. He said, to affect the quality of the day, that is the highest art.
I love it.
You do that when you open yourself to beauty. So in 2010, the sculptor Patrick Daugherty was commissioned to build a piece at Dumbarton Oaks that would integrate the landscape with his stick sculptures. Now, Daugherty is a North Carolina artist, and he has made sculptures out of saplings, which he calls stick works, for a long time. And he goes to a place, and then he conceives of a piece that he can integrate with the natural setting or whatever. And so he conceived the piece to weave and whirl around the ellipse's aerial hedge. Well, the aerial hedge is there's an ellipse at Dumbarton. It's quite large. And the trees are pruned so that the growth, all the leaf growth and branches are on top of the trees. And so it makes like an aerial hedge. It's above your head. And this, so there's a double row of these small forest trees, and they're meant to do that. So Daugherty decided to
make a sculpture that he could weave into the aerial hedge. And he called his creation Easy Rider because he saw his sculptures as agents of freedom. So it turns the circle of trees into kind of an imaginary merry-go-round. He said, "I was thinking of the hedge as something to ride on. This would break up the symmetry a bit and bring in the surprise element of these things as coming up from the ground and being entangled and having a bit of a swirl." So Peter and I volunteer to help. The way Dougherty works is he conceives of a piece, he draws it up, and he makes a very careful sort of plan, because every sculpture has to be completed within a certain amount of time. And then, so he sort of functions as a coach while the people are, all of his volunteers like us, are clipping and stripping and hauling and digging and climbing and weaving the saplings into this strange sort of dwellings. It looks sort of like giant basket weaving. It was fun. It was people of all ages come to help. Ooh, and it's hot and it was hard work. And so Dougherty walks around saying, "Oh, great, do this here," or he'll just sort of, you know, like a little bit, take a little stick and weave it in for you. So, you know, so his hand is in it. And there's a book of his work. It's called Patrick Dougherty's Stick Work. And after time in nature, maybe a year and a half or two, they begin to erode the sculpture, and many people have been surprised by this creation, trying to figure out, did it grow here in the trees? How did this thing get there? And then it gets taken down. So recently, the horticulturists at Dumbarton decided that they had to bite the bullet. They needed to give the trees and the ellipse better soil and better drainage. So now all the trees have been replaced, and they're saplings now. They had to plant new early trees. But now when I go to Dumbarton, I have that nice memory of having been there.
Memory.
Yeah, it was lovely. And Andy Goldsworthy is another well-known sculptor of nature. You've probably seen his film Rivers and Tides, and which follows him sculpting with icicles and petals floating down the stream and stone walls. And he would lay down in the rain to get the fleeting image of his body as the rain darkened the pavement around him. His work can be that impermanent or very permanent, like these meandering stone walls. I was interested that he has been picked up as an environmental artist, but he says he uses whatever he has to get what he wants. He's not that kind of a purist. And a lot of what he wants are the photographs, because everything else is sort of, you know, impermanent.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. He's a wonderful artist. Mm-hmm. Well, the quality of one's day, as Thoreau put it, must engage the senses. And the gardens at Dumbarton Oaks, or any garden for that matter, engage a heightened aesthetic. And that's which engages the senses, all the senses. This is what should happen when you're in nature. I would like to mention something here, that the presence of nature is more than a physical space. Surrendering to the awesome quality of nature, and I had to put that word in because a student used that word about six times this week inappropriately. And I was biting my tongue to tell her how inappropriate the use of the word awesome was. But what does awesome mean? It means something that is extremely impressive or daunting, inspiring great admiration, apprehension, or fear. Well, I think nature fits that bill. Awesome, unfortunately, has become to mean something else in today's lingo. I do not consider looking at a masterpiece of art awesome in the same way I see nature. Nature is of a higher essence. That's my own little pet peeve, maybe. But nature is a much higher essence than looking at a masterpiece, Leonardo, whatever. Mm. Well, Leonardo had something to say about sensuality as well. And in many ways, Leonardo's aesthetic was all about the senses. Most of us probably don't know he was a fantastic cook. He was also a vegetarian. And he was a great athlete of strength and superb poise and posture. And additionally, he was the greatest lute player of the world at the time. And he had a fantastic singing voice. He used to woo the audiences with his great voice way before Sinatra. and his sensual experience was what gave him a sense of being. And he had a hierarchy to senses, too. And he writes, "The eye, the window of the soul, is the chief means whereby the understanding can most fully and abundantly appreciate the infinite works of nature. The ear is second," end quote. So he always thought the visual experience mm-hmm. was higher than the ear, we'll say. Mm-hmm. Well, there are other senses like touch, smell, and taste, and they were further down on his list. Leonardo calls it the works of nature. That's the word he uses, the works as nature, as if something has been created. Uh-huh. And the creation of nature is in itself a work, just like any other sort of artwork.
Well, that's right. I agree. Still, I'm very partial to artists, you know. There's a terrific film called The Dream of Light. It follows the Spanish painter Antonio Lopez as he begins a painting of a quince tree in his backyard. And he's struggling to capture a perfect fleeting moment of beauty on his canvas. He starts with drawings, and then he drives in pegs in his in the ground to set his feet in the same place. So he's always standing exactly in relation to the quince tree and to his canvas. And then as things happen, the fruit starts to get ripe and sort of starts to hang. And he hangs, puts strings across to track the weight going down, so he knows where he started and he knows what he is. And then, of course, the weather is his enemy, and it starts raining like crazy, and then he has to dig trenches under his feet to let the rain drain out, and then he has to put up a canopy of plastic so that he can get out of the rain. And then friends come and go, and he's getting more and more depressed, and every day is about the weather, which is really not, I mean, you know, we're saying about nature.
He's surrendering.
Is stronger
to it.
Than he is. And so his friends come and they'll carry on talking to him. And finally, it's just too much and he has to give up. It's maybe 4 months that he tried to do this. And it's a really wonderful film. So
sounds terrific.
It's great, called The Dream of Light. And there are so many contemporary artists who get inspirations from gardens. Of course, Georgia O'Keeffe, we know, and Ellsworth Kelly, who is really a minimalist artist. His paintings are flat, beautiful combinations of colors, perfect combinations, maybe two colors. And his work is now being shown at Glenstone. But he also did always, through his life, he has drawn very simple line drawings of plants. And then Lee Krasner, she did some really ballsy collages using plants as the starting point. And I have to talk about Charles Birchfield, because his spirit would hit me over the head if I didn't mention his eerie Forbidden Gardens. They are so neat.
Yes, they're very mysterious.
Oh my gosh, he has his own language. And you can almost hear the crickets chirping away.
And the crows.
Yes, the crows, yes. So check him out, Charles Birchfield. And then there's Joseph Stella and Jennifer Bartlett, who's a contemporary artist, and she did a series of abstracted gardens that are very powerful.
Well, you know, it's really kind of evident when you're going through the lovely gardens of Dumbarton Oaks that that everyone has the ability to develop a garden, but not necessarily the garden that they have, because that comes from wealth, and there's a richness that comes in partaking that in a public place, and we're lucky that we can go there. But it had thoughtfully conceived financial backing. But while walking in the gardens, I thought about the primitive and peasant gardens that I've experienced in marvelous moments of my life. And it has nothing to do with money. It has something to do with sustenance and beauty. Have you awoken up early in the morning to see a squash blossom open before your very eyes and witness the hummingbird sticking its beak into a flower as its wings buzz in energy and delight? I can recall staring at several gardens of just artichokes, one kind of variety of plant. I was mesmerized by the spiky and intimidating beauty of an incredible plant. I am lost in thought now when I think about that beauty in the gardens in Italy and in Crete that I saw, just artichoke gardens. There's something beautiful about a peasant garden, nothing fancy about them. And in the essence of Mediterranean aromas like lemon blossoms, orange blossoms, and jasmine, these are fragrances that bring you to another place that feels healthier and right. The blood pressure drops, the breathing normalizes, and possibly some synesthetic experience emerges. All you're doing is looking at the nature. Nature is experience. Well, the gardens have evolved in the 21st century, and now we're talking about urban gardens, rooftop gardens, community gardens, architectural gardens in skyscrapers and on skylines. This is something we need as a human race. Still, there is a small segment of the population that pathetically doesn't find it important. That I haven't wrapped my head around yet. But I think experience the garden and nature is a cultural imperative, but it's not always been this way.
Well, you know, there are other traditions of gardening beyond the European upper-class tradition exemplified by Dumbarton. The Japanese and Asian gardens, of course, have been very important to these cultures. And in Spain, since it's more like a desert, the plants are very, you know, like succulents and huge century plants that have one flower that sort of like a tree up through the plant. And there are so many different kinds of gardens, but I'm particularly drawn to the southern traditions in the U.S. of African-American gardening. One of these traditions comes from working yards in the rural South with chain link fences for keeping hogs in or out, areas for slaughtering hogs, for cooking, for growing vegetables. Well, these are the yards that came about when African Americans began to have their own places, and they could have that luxury of, which we don't even see as a luxury, of growing flowers. And flowers and vegetables were not ever planted together. So these yards have swept dirt ground. I love it. There's no grass. And flowers in all sorts of containers. Where do these ideas come from? Years ago, I brought a book by Richard Westmacott, A Formal Study of the Horticulture and History of These Gardens. These traditions date from long ago. Styles from West Africa have become mixed in, and you can see these yards in the South and also in Washington, D.C. So the dirt is swept. It's a daily chore. Vegetables and flowers are not mixed, and the flowers are grown in barrels, tires, troughs, chicken feeders, old wash tubs. You know, when the tires are cut and made to sort of like a flower, where they sort of I'm bad at explaining it, but you can imagine painted white mostly, and then all kinds of the most colorful flowers are planted in them. And ornaments were made out of rocks and jars and snuff bottles and brown Clorox bottles, soda bottles filled with colored liquid. Flowers were chosen for maximum brightness and mixed all together. If two flowers were the same, they would be separated by a white flower. And the annuals, petunias, marigolds, 4 o'clocks, perennials were cannas, irises, daylilies, wild azaleas. It's incredible. And so now there's like become like this garden mix of cultures where, you know, like you can see this all over Washington.
It's fantastic.
It's so beautiful.
No, it really, really is an amazing kind of this is, we're kind of talking about the evolution of the garden.
Yes.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Sheila. And well, today, Sheila and I asked you to, you know, leave your pencils and sketchbooks behind, your paints and brushes and canvases home, and just enjoy nature's art in the form of itself. There's a quote at Dumbarton Oaks, and it reads in Latin, quod severus metis, and it means you reap what you sow. Metaphorically, you will enjoy great rewards in visiting the gardens and experiencing gardens that will serve as art forms that share experience and growth. We hope you've enjoyed the show. And Sheila, talk real quickly about a show that we have in the future, or do we have a show?
We're always in flux.
We're going to wing it next time.
Yeah, be surprised. Maybe the Women's Museum.
Okay,
maybe
we'll
something
see.
Else.
I like the winging it part.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can't wing it with Bobby Hill because he's up next. And Bobby really is going to share his incredible knowledge of musical depth, which he does every Saturday from 10 to 1 p.m. We've got avant-garde jazz right here. So keep that dial for Bobby, and he's going to take over with that vibe this Saturday afternoon. Well, we hope you go to the website and look at a fantastic program schedule. There's all kinds of great stuff happening here at WOWD. Experience art and the visual and everything you do. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
The paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel and a beauty and a swing and hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? Pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, put away the DDT now. So give me spots on my apple, believe me, the birds and the bees, please. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got to lose? Pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Last night I heard the screen door slam, and a big old taxi took over my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got to lose? The great paradise, but in the parking lot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got to lose? Paradise, put up a parking lot.
And you're tuned to WOWD LP, Tacoma Park.